On this episode of Baseball Barbacast, we celebrate our three new Hall of Famers, Ichiro Suzuki, CC Sabathia, Billy Wagner. We talk about the voting results. Jordan is back, and he gets to tell you if the Dodgers are bad for baseball or not. And of course, a Friday edition of The Good, The Bad, and The Ugly. Hello and welcome to Baseball Barbacast, the only baseball podcast in the world that knows who didn't vote for Ichiro. I'm Jake Mintz. That's Jordan Schusterman. And listen to the whole pod. You'll learn the news at the end.
You have to stay seated. Don't worry. We have the answer. No. That is some pretty sensitive information. I imagine if I came across that info, who decided to look at Ichiro's name and say, nope. Not quite yet, young man. That would be an interesting piece of info to know.
Let's actually begin with this. Ichiro in the Hall of Fame, CC Sabathia in the Hall of Fame, Billy Wagner in the Hall of Fame. We'll talk about that. Also the Dodgers, also Good, Bad, Ugly, this episode of Baseball Barbacast. If you found out, just you, Jordan Schusterman, who did not vote for Ichiro? Ichiro, who received every single vote but one. If that info found its way into your inbox, what would you do with it?
I think I might try and do what Ichiro said he would like to do, which is invite him over to dinner and have a chat. And just be like, what's the idea here? We will, of course, dig more into Ichiro and his failed quest for a unanimous Hall of Fame induction. But he is in. I am wearing my Mariners cap in honor of Ichiro, a legend of the franchise. Him, CC, and Billy Wagner officially going into the Hall of Fame this year. I love how fast all of this happens once the induction occurs on Sunday. Like, they are immediately, like, in Cooperstown, like just a few days later. Like, it's all very, very, very quick. And I also love, because of the goofy voting process, the class, like the combination of players that go in together is essentially random, because it's just when these guys go on the ballot and when they ultimately get to 75%. So to have Ichiro and CC with Billy Wagner, who's been waiting for, you know, more than a decade to have this happen, is both very cool. And then you have kind of these strange crossovers where they are almost forced to talk about each other's careers in comparison, and it's a little strange sometimes, but I like it. And this was a cool trio to see hanging out together for a day in Cooperstown.
Yeah, well, they have the direct flights into Cooperstown, the bustling airport.
The PJs, man. I mean, don't doubt the power of rich people's private jets. Although I don't know, does Billy Wagner have private jet money? I'm not so sure he does.
I don't think he does. Ichiro certainly does. CC certainly does. But Billy Wagner, who is still a high school baseball coach, again, we got a nice shot of him in his house receiving the news. Really, you know, emotional. That was touching to see. It looks like a nice house. He has a pool table in there. So it's not as if he's, you know, scrounging up for coin. However, I don't think he's got PJ money.
Yeah, but I assume Cooperstown's covering whatever expenses they need. But that's part of it too, right? Is the emotion of, it's a very different phone call, right? The one that Billy Wagner is receiving versus the one that Ichiro is receiving. You know, we're spending time talking about someone who took 10 years to finally get in, who started on the ballot at, I believe, 10% was the amount of support that he got in his first year, to someone who, of course, we all thought was going to get 100% of the vote. So it's a strange process. Every year we go through it, we kind of have all this discourse about it. But now it's time to celebrate, right? So let's at least spend a little bit of time talking about these three players now that they're officially in. Not that it was a surprise for CC or for Ichiro, but certainly for Wagner, I think this is when we can stop arguing and just be like, all right, this is cool.
And let's start with Wagner. No matter whether you think he should be in or not, I hope that once he's in, you do turn the dial to appreciation. And that is the unfortunate part of the Hall of Fame debate, is that you end up just picking these phenomenal players apart. If you're on the ballot at all, you had a career that 95% of Major League Baseball players would die for, right? And so adore Billy Wagner. I think his story is fascinating, going from the hills of Appalachia, pitching at a miniature Division III college where he set strikeout records, to becoming like a legit high pick, right? It wasn't like people knew, like when you saw Billy Wagner in college, it was like, that's 100 miles an hour.
What's he doing here?
And when you talk to people about facing him, they were like, it was invisible. Like you just didn't see it. And there's so much emphasis now in pitching development on the approach of a fastball and the angle it takes going through the strike zone. Billy Wagner was doing that before we knew what it was. And just to see him get to celebrate that moment, that was so cool. So cheers to Billy Wagner, who, when I wrote a long story about him a couple years ago, what a delight to talk to on the phone. Really humble cat. I'm very, very happy for Billy Wagner.
This is a very reliever thing, but being an all-star with four different teams is pretty cool. Not to mention, you know, a lot of it happened late in his career. I do like, you know, he clearly associates strongest with Houston, but for him to make a real impact, of course, in Philadelphia, New York, and even in Atlanta, to see the guy that, you know, was, as you mentioned, Ferrum College, baby. I mean, this is just something. And by the way, Ferrum College, and it's at a time where, like, yeah, it was D3 sports similar to as we know it now. I mean, facing schools and people that we know, this isn't, you know, a version of college baseball that we can't conceive of. I mean, this is, you know, this is the 90s. This is a time when, you know, Division III had becoming to, it was a real thing at that point. And so now we can relate to it in a pretty stunning way.
Ferrum College, current undergraduate student population of 760, in the town of Ferrum, Virginia, which has a town population of 2,043. Yeah. So we're not talking about New York City. Speaking of New York City.
Yeah. Can I just say the one other Billy Wagner thing that I think that we should mention? I feel like we basically have never talked about it since. I know we haven't in past years because it hasn't been as relevant. Is the fact that his kid is a big leaguer. You know, we talk about how, you know, oh, this guy, against all odds for him to become that guy. You know, when all stars who went to SEC schools have kids that go on to play professional baseball, we're like, yeah, duh. But for Billy Wagner to have a kid who's now a major leaguer and like a pretty good one, and Will Wagner, who's going to have, I mean, depends on how many more free agent signings the Blue Jays make, but like, he's going to be a major leaguer. I mean, he already has made it. And I think that's also a cool kind of subplot that we now get to kind of keep talking about Billy Wagner in that sense.
Also, part of the reason Billy Wagner retired somewhat prematurely, when he still had the goods, all-star in his final season, was so that he could be around his kids and coach his kids. Mm-hmm. He was, and still is, the head baseball coach at the Miller School in Charlottesville, Virginia, where his son Will played. And like, I know he didn't kind retire so his kid could be a big leaguer. Right. Like, that's not why you do these things necessarily. Right. But that's a win, man.
Yeah. And if it was going to take him that long to get into the Hall of Fame, he needed to retire sooner rather than later, or else we'd still be waiting.
Bingo. Bingo.
He could have kept pitching clearly into his 40s if he wanted to, but it worked out. So Will Wagner, I'm glad now for the rest of his career, we get to keep saying Billy Wagner's name. I think that is fun.
I need to see where the Toronto Blue Jays are playing on induction weekend as you talk about CeCe Sabathia.
Oh, yes. That is a good point. All right. So let's talk about CeCe. CeCe is great. And he's someone that, obviously, when we talk about Ichiro, we've wrestled as popular as it gets. But man, I mean, as far as Yankees go, it's tough to dislike CeCe Sabathia. You know, you have, there's certainly players, obviously he certainly had some opponents that did not, that he had his tussles with, that he had his beefs with Tampa, right? I'm sure there are times when the Rays were not particularly big fans of CeCe Sabathia, but man, what a guy, what a story, what a career to pitch as long as he did, to go through his battles off the field that he did, to kind of come out the other side as such a incredibly introspective and insightful and open and honest voice in our sport, to go along with just an unbelievable amount of on-field achievements and a career arc going from, I mean, he's talked about this before on his pod, and just hearing what CC was like when he, you know, was a teenage, a high schooler from California, being dropped into the minor leagues with Cleveland and like being homesick and saying he wants to go home because it's like, this ain't for me. Like, what am I doing here? To then making the big leagues as fast as he did, to growing up in Cleveland, to having his epic run with Milwaukee, and then, of course, an iconic career with the Yankees. It's a very complete baseball life. And I guess you could say that that's usually the case for Hall of Famers because they play for so long and because they're so good. But there's just so much to love about this CC Sabathia story on and off the field. And that's what makes me so excited for him and obviously anyone that's gotten to know him.
So you mentioned his off-the-field struggles. I mean, this is from an article written in 2021 by CC Sabathia in GQ. I'm just going to read a couple sentences from it. I was standing in a damp cinder block storage room under Camden Yards, the home of the Baltimore Orioles, wearing my New York Yankees t-shirt and gray uniform pants at 10 o'clock on a Sunday morning, searching for another bottle of Hennessy. Ever since I got to the ballpark, I had been going back and forth from the clubhouse to the storage room, pouring myself drinks. In a half hour, I was scheduled to throw a bullpen, my workout between starts. I was so blasted, I couldn't walk straight. I had come back from three surgeries and fought through hundreds of hangovers. The one thing I could always do was throw when I was supposed to. Now the room was spinning. There was no way I could take the ball and throw it without embarrassing myself. Man, what am I doing? This is someone who is in a very dark place, clearly, and handled his journey out of that place with immense grace throughout, with immense, like, with complete honesty. It didn't need to. Like, this is not something that CC Sabathia needs to make public, right? And I think by doing so, it does have an impact on people who are going through similar struggles. So obviously that's something that is a process throughout CC's life and will always be there, and he'll always have to monitor that. But like, you just have to give this person so much credit and so much kudos for how he has just become this icon off the field in a number of ways, you know?
Yeah. And the last thing I would say about that is, like, obviously what's most important is that he got the help he needed and that he was able to become a healthier human. That's first and foremost. But if you do zoom in on the baseball context, right? I mean, this is 2015. The fact that he's able to reach that scary place and then come back and throw another 600, 700 solid innings in the major leagues after that, you know, throughout the rest of his Yankees tenure is amazing. And also part of why he got to the big fancy round numbers that he did. You know, like, I think he would have still had a pretty decent chance at being a Hall of Famer if his career had ended around 2015 or 2016. But I'm so glad it didn't. And now it's like, yeah, of course CC Sabathia. Like, duh, he got to all these numbers that we're never going to see pitchers reach ever again. And that's part of his story, which is really, really cool.
And one of the members of the Black Aces, the Black starting pitchers who won at least 20 games in a season, now he will probably be one of the last to ever do it because no one's winning 20 games in a season anymore. We probably have to change that threshold. Like, if Hunter Green goes out there, wins 18 games and wins the Cy Young with a 2-2.
Yeah. Like, that's interesting, but I like it. Hunter Green is yeah, but wins are random enough. You know, I think so, that will be cool, but it's true. It's a very, very different standard.
Right. And so he did it in 2010, David Price did it in 2012. But yeah, what a guy, dude. What a guy.
Yeah.
The Q rating on CC is immense. Arguably, though, not as immense, not as high, not as complete, not as universal as Ichiro. And for me, for Ichiro, it is the idea that no one has a reason to dislike this person, to not enjoy this person, except for, I guess, the person who didn't vote for him. Because, you know, if you're a Yankees fan, you hated David Ortiz. If you were a Red Sox fan, you hated Derek Jeter. Most teams have rivals. And while, yes, the Mariners were like beating under Ichiro various AL West teams, you didn't hate Ichiro. There's no way, dude. There's no way. And so I think there is an argument. He is the most universally beloved baseball player of all time. I think the most people and highest percentage of people loved Ichiro.
Have a positive feeling towards Ichiro. Yeah, man. I mean, you know, for me, this is someone who he fits in the bucket of starstruck, I would say, for me. Because for those who don't know, like, he's still around all the time, the Mariners spring training. Like, I remember it was last year being stopping by Peoria, and he's just there, full uniform, playing catch. Like, he's just, and this was true even at the end of his career when he came back in 2019, played the two games in Japan, and then was still around and basically on the field after every game, coming out of the tunnel after every win. Like, he's still such a huge part of that franchise, and it's incredible. Of course, they announced that they're going to retire his number. I mean, all the things that you would expect. But for me, it's also interesting because, I mean, for those of you who don't know, like, the Mariners became my favorite team in high school, not because of Ichiro, it's because of Felix, who, you know, we can mention here, got 20% of the ballot of the vote, and he will continue to be in Hall of Fame discussions in years to come. But everyone just assumes, like, oh, well, it's Ichiro and Griffey. It's like, well, yeah, of course I love Ichiro. Who doesn't love Ichiro and Griffey, right? But Ichiro hit what he did from, whatever, making 11 straight All-Star games, or I guess 10 straight All-Star games to start his career. And that was before I was watching the Mariners every day. But then you go back and look at it, and it's the same kind of thing that we kind of talk about with pitchers. It's just like, this kind of player is just impossible to imagine existing, you know? And it's like, okay, sure, yeah, we have Luis Urias getting 200 hits every year, every season, but what is he not doing? Stealing 30 bases or playing unbelievable defense in right field, you know?
And or so, doing the hitting as well as Ichiro was. Like, Luis Urias is the best at what he does now.
And it's not close.
Ichiro was a tier better than him.
100%. 100%. And so to have that, I mean, yeah, it's ridiculous to have that much consistency, to never miss games, to have the speed component, to have the defense component, to have the arm component, right? That was part of his legendary talent that of course you only got to see every so often, but it was everything. And I've said it too, like, for him to be intentionally walked as often as he was is amazing. It doesn't make any sense. It says a little bit about where the Mariners were as a franchise, but it also speaks to just kind of the respect and fear for even having him, you know, dump a ball over the shortstop's head or lineman into the gap. So everything about him, he is as mythical and mystical as they come, and yet kind of in the same way that we talked about with Ricky Henderson. You know, with Ichiro, it's a little bit different because we only have so many glimpses and moments of him speaking English publicly, even though everybody understands that he understands it and can speak it fine. It's more select, the insights that we get into Ichiro the human, but that also makes it all the better because it's not as overwhelming. It's not like you don't know exactly when you're going to get that Ichiro soundbite that means more than anything else. So that's also part of it. And then the other obvious takeaway is my God, am I excited for his Hall of Fame speech? You know, I don't say that about it. I mean, you could say that about all three of these guys as these careers start to mean more to us because we remember their careers more. But this is certainly a Hall of Fame speech that I think people have been talking about for a long time. And I think a lot of people are going to be really excited about that this summer.
Should we go?
I don't know. This is the other problem is it's always like around the trade deadline. And I've always thought like, I'm like saving it for the Felix one or for whatever, but it would be
You should go before Felix. So, you know, the lay of the
land. That's true. We have been to the Hall of Fame, but only once. And it's been a long time, but we got connections there. We can try to,
yeah, we should go for that. Ichiro, dude, what a thing. I'm so cool, man. Again, first Japanese player of the Hall of Fame. Like, that in and of itself is enormous. When I was in Japan, let me look at my watch, last week, literally a week ago today, I went to the Japanese Baseball Hall of Fame, which is attached to the Tokyo Dome, and Ichiro got in this year, okay? So he is also in the 2025 class of the Japanese Baseball Hall of Fame, which was very interesting to see. Like, how did you just get around to this? I guess they have similar requirements, even though he did it. Like, he had not played in Japan since 2000. Like, I think his professional career to wait. But he's, dude, oh, it's so cool. It's so cool. Very briefly on the unanimity.
Yes.
So what, dude? So what? Would it have been cool if every single voter had voted for Ichiro, making him only the second player of all time to get that honor? More on that, more on Mariano in a second. Yes, that would have been very cool. Very cool. But that one person's opinion of Ichiro does not meaningfully change the way we talk about him. And when you go back in time and you understand that like Willie Mays and Hank Aaron didn't get 100% of the vote, it's like, so what? They're both better than Ichiro. They both, right? Like, Ichiro's amazing. Willie Mays didn't get 100% of the vote. So if Willie Mays didn't get 100% of the vote, like, what the hell are we doing here? Right? So it disqualifies that as an honor to me, right? Like, if it's like, it's just a statistical quirk, which I think is interesting and fun to follow and fun to think about. Like, the next player who has a chance is going to be Albert Pujols in a couple years. But it doesn't alter the story, if that makes sense.
Yeah. Albert's 100% is hinging on whether Escogido wins the Lidom championship this year.
Looking good.
Yeah. The thing about the unanimous stuff is the instant reaction is, oh, how could you not vote for Ichiro? But it's like, you have to remember that whoever this person is, it's not about Ichiro. It's about that person. Like, that's the whole point. Like, you're giving this decision too much credit to think about like, oh, this is why you could maybe not, or like, cause again, it's not, that's a waste of your time. It's not about that. Like,
yeah,
whoever's deciding not to vote for him, it's about that person. And it's about something that is a choice that they are not voting for anybody. Now, what I'm most curious about is, did that person vote for anybody else? Or is this a blank ballot? Because you can submit a blank ballot. That does happen. We don't often hear about those ones publicly, but that is the issue. So I think wondering like, oh, what could they not? They dislike Ichiro. Like, I do not think this is someone that disliked Ichiro. I think this is someone who is refusing to vote for anybody on the first ballot. That's really
awesome. This is someone who dislikes themselves, right. It appears.
Right.
Very briefly, the only other player, or excuse me, still the only player to receive 100% of the vote, Mariano Rivera. Really disturbing story that came out this week that Mariano Rivera and his wife were accused of covering up a report of sex abuse at their church and their house. This story is still developing. You should go read about it. We're not going to offer takes on this besides, if true, very bad.
Yeah.
And is a reminder that we also like don't know these people at all, right? Like, yep. If this is true about Mariano Rivera, there's an argument that he should be removed from the Hall of Fame. This is that damning to me. We can have that conversation when we get there. Obviously not as important as the health and well-being of the people involved. Like,
yeah. Yeah, I mean, it's very disturbing. And it's part, as your first point is the most salient as it stands right now, which is that any discourse around these people and as Hall of Famers is not that important, but it is also a reminder that we don't know anything. And so having any definitive conversations about certain people is probably foolhardy, despite all the, of course, praise we just showered on people that we don't know that well, but we work with the information that we have, and that is what we're going to do.
Cece, I feel like we know.
Yeah. I feel pretty good.
Right,
like I feel pretty good about these people, but again, like I said, yeah, you know, I think the point has been made, so we will obviously continue to monitor that rather upsetting story, which unfortunately became relevant as we were just talking about Mariano Rivera, of course, getting 100% of the vote. A couple other things briefly on the Hall of Fame before we take a break. Any other big takeaways? You know, we had these three that we felt pretty good about. We're all going to get in. None of them were huge surprises. Of course, Wagner was a long wait, but because we had the results from the tracker, we had a good idea that he was going to get in. You know, we thought Andrew Jones would maybe make a little bit more progress. We thought Carlos Beltran did getting over 70%, I think tells us that it could be as soon as next year that he gets into the Hall of Fame.
Big winner here, Carlos Beltran, because now next year he's going to go in alone. The 2026 ballot is kind of buns. Like, there is no one on the ballot next year for the first time who will get in at all, I think. Like, Cole Hamels is the best case scenario. Like, he's the best player, and there's an argument for Cole Hamels, and maybe it changes over time. I don't think he will get in. And so you could have a whole class of players entering the ballot that don't even have a shot. And so it could just be him and the Veterans Committee for next
year. Yeah, well, I was going to say, there is still, as we should also mention now, right, like Dick Allen and Dave Parker also being inducted this year because of them getting in off of a Veterans Committee. So I can't speak to the, I know that those committees rotate in terms of when they do them. So I don't know exactly who would potentially be on that ballot next year. But yeah, you're right. It could just be Beltran. That would really be kind of a hilarious outcome after you consider the discourse around him having to wait.
Well, George Eastman, if you looked at our podcast document, you would see that your friend Jake Mintz included a list of the potential candidates for the 2026 Contemporary Baseball Committee.
How about that?
Just going to turbo mode them. Albert Bell, Barry Bonds, Roger Clemens, Carlos Delgado, Dwight Evans, Keith Hernandez, Jeff Kent, Kenny Lofton, Don Mattingly, Dale Murphy, Curt Schilling, Gary Sheffield, Lou Whitaker, Bernie Williams.
So I'm glad you have this on here because shame on me for not looking at our podcast document. The reason I wasn't sure is because these eras rotate. So they basically every year they vote on a different actual era or time frame of player. But my understanding is this will be the first time that we have Bonds and Clemens, and we don't know for sure if they'll put them on this committee, although it seems likely that they would put them up. And just a reminder about how these committees work, this is a much, much smaller. I mean, this is, I think, 16 voters who have to vote on these former players, executives that are on this committee. And I've wondered this since it became clear that Bonds and Clemens were not going to get in. Like, they probably will someday with the right combination of people from, you know, a Veterans Committee. Is that going to happen this coming year? I don't know, because I don't know who's on the committee. And I don't, it's all kind of random who's involved, but I think it will happen someday. But it's interesting that that could already happen as soon as this year.
They should put him in next year so we get the whole cheater class with Beltran. You do Beltran, Bonds, Clemens, Sheffield, just put it, you know.
That's true. We could find some other transgressions we could put in there. But no, that's good. That is interesting. And Beltran in great shape for next year. As I already mentioned, you know, Felix getting 20% was certainly warmed my heart and made me feel like, oh, yeah. And here's the other thing. You have to, after we've had guys like Helton and now guys like Wagner, like, if this is how it works, man, you just got to make some progress every year and you're probably going to get in at some point. So Felix will be a big part of that. And I think Hamels will join that conversation because you're going to start seeing those careers kind of compared in an interesting way. But other than that, Utley also made some pretty big gains this year. So he's another one that could maybe slowly make the climb there. Andrew Jones is feeling a little stuck. He got 62% last year, 66% this year. He's got two more years on the ballot. Does he sneak in at some point? I guess we will see.
Let's take a break. And when we get back, we will sing every single word to the song Hall of Fame by The Script. And welcome back, Baseball Barbercast. Jake Mintz, Jordan Schusterman, no singing. The Los Angeles Dodgers officially introduced Roky Sasaki, giving him number 11 to wear on his back, which is relevant because that's what Miguel Rojas was wearing. He's now changing to number 72, which is adorable. Roky wearing 11, maybe in part because of Yu Darvish, feels like one heck of a crap consolation prize for him and the San Diego Padres.
More on the Padres in a little bit when we talk about Jerickson Profar. So Roky's officially a Dodger. He's hanging out with LeBron at the Lakers game. He is doing his interview. Dodger Stadium undergoing some pretty serious renovations right now. So they're kind of doing their pressers outside. It's not as glossy as some of their other pressers, but they're making it work as they sign superstar after superstar. Tanner Scott also being introduced earlier this week. I have not had an opportunity to talk into a microphone about Roky Sasaki to the Dodgers. And so I'm not just going to rehash everything. Although since I have returned from vacation, I have also been thinking about this. I know that the discourse has rolled on without me. I have seen a good amount of it in the time that I have, checked in here and there. Poolside as I was on vacation. So there, I definitely have some thoughts about this, and we certainly received some feedback. I listened to your conversation with Andy McCullough about this, which I enjoyed. And so now we want to at least have one more extended opportunity to discuss where we are with Roki and the Dodgers and the Dodgers in general.
And we're going to open up the mailbag here because we got some critical feedback. And for self-improvement...
You got. You got. And Andy, I am exempt here. This lovely email from listener Dalton, I guess he mentions me, but he knows I did not say any of these things. Although, guess what, Dalton? I will probably say some things that will lump me in to Jake and Andy's take. So go ahead.
Dear Jake and Jordan, I've been a devoted listener for 3 years. Thank you so much. That said, this is the first time I've reached out, and I wanted to share some thoughts on Jake's recent comments about Sasaki's decision to join the Dodgers and the frustration of small market team fans. So Dalton makes 3 points. There are 3 paragraphs. We're going to read one and then respond to it and kind of go through it. This is our lens to have this conversation. First, as a Padres fan, admittedly biased, I'd like to push back on the idea that the Dodgers' pitching development and roster of Japanese superstars are, quote, light years ahead of what other teams, including the Padres, can offer. He mentions the development of players like Seth Lugo and Michael King under pitching coach Ruben Niebla. They've invested in a cutting-edge biomechanics lab, significant Japanese representation with players like Yu Darvish and Yuki Matsui, and front office personnel like Hideo Nomo. While our ownership situation likely hurt our chances with Sasaki, I don't think the Dodgers were leaps and bounds ahead in other areas. Jordan.
Yeah, I mean, I think this is fair. You guys kind of touched on this when talking about how a lot of the discourse around leading up to Sasaki signing is, this was my struggle with it too, is the reports between what we heard directly from his agent versus what we heard directly from people reporting what they think was important. And we had this notion that he cared about pitching development. What is going to help me be the best pitcher that I can be? And the reality is there are a lot of teams that are good at this. Not that many, but there's a select number of teams, and the Padres are one of them. A lot of the teams that are good at them all have something specific that they can sell. So it's true. He could only pick one team. And I think with the Dodgers in particular, I think the thing that when we talk about development, it's such a big phrase. Like, what are we talking about? Are we talking about getting guys to the big leagues? Are we talking about turning 12th round picks into top 100 prospects? Are we talking about turning good pitchers into great pitchers? There's a lot of ways you can sell that process. And I know that Tyler Glasnow spoke publicly, who's, of course, you know, shares an agent with Sasaki. And of course, I'm sure he communicated this, like what you get once you are on the Dodgers, those kinds of resources are exquisite. And maybe they're also awesome in San Diego. So it's just so hard to say. Like, pitching development is such a big term that there are many teams that were good at it. And I think focusing too much on that is probably not worth it in retrospect.
Yeah. So my big response to this is every single Dodgers game is on national television in Japan. And if we're talking about why he made his decision, I think that is relevant. I think that the status of the Dodgers in Japan as a whole is relevant. And I do think that it was maybe unfair to classify the Dodgers as light years ahead, but they are clearly really, really good at this thing. That is accepted. They are maybe less good at keeping guys healthy, right? As we, especially compared to the Mariners. I take your point, Dalton. I do think that the main argument here that the Dodgers were the most alluring, most enticing location remains true.
And I want to hit one other point here because this isn't going to come up in his 2 other points of feedback. But this is another thing that I just want to mention because I've been thinking about it and I don't think you guys necessarily touched on it. I just hinted at it a couple minutes ago. I think what was really challenging with the fan response and, oh, was this all a charade? He was always going to the Dodgers, goes back to the words that his agent said at the winter meetings about, oh, he had a lot of trouble with the media in Japan. And you could make an argument where his words that he could belong in a small market. I don't think Joel Wolf necessarily misled anybody. I think he was trying to be as transparent and honest as possible. But the other thing that Joel Wolf said at that point at the winter meetings was that he had not talked to Roki Sasaki specifically about any of this yet. He was like, yes, this is where I am at now at the very beginning stages of this process. Obviously, he had represented him, and I'm sure they had had vague conversations about where this could go directionally. So I'm not meaning this to defend Joel Wolf as much as just to be like, the degree to which how we talked about what Sasaki wanted was funneled through those initial words was, I think, unfair and unhelpful, because ultimately we didn't hear anything from him until he just spoke at the Dodgers press conference the other day, where he talked about how he valued the stability of the front office with the Dodgers, and he valued, you know, having the connections and the support system that they had there. And not that other teams like the Padres couldn't offer that, but everyone making fun of him for picking the Dodgers because he didn't want the attention of the media, like, we don't know what any of this means. And there's ways for him to be made, you know, and felt comfortable. And the point that I've made too, we just watched this with Yamamoto, by the way, like, it's the Ohtani show no matter what. You could say, oh, now he's going to be with the Dodgers. There's just so many kids. Like, yes, that's true. There will be more attention, I guess, than if he goes to the Reds. But it's all about Ohtani. Like, Ohtani shields him in a way and offers him the support in the clubhouse every day to transition to be a major leaguer in a way that, you know, yes, of course, Yu Darvish could. But the pressure on him in some ways would maybe be bigger in San Diego.
Yeah. It's not like there are additional Japanese media members coming to L.A. now because of Sasaki, right? Like, right. We've maxed out.
Yeah. Well, Ohtani, I wouldn't say, right? We've maxed out, but if we're getting more, it's, you just know, because it's more Ohtani stuff. It's not because of Sasaki. So I just want to make that point.
Let's move on. Second point. I wanted to address your response to complaints about the Dodgers' impact on baseball. Losing Sasaki and seeing former Padres Tanner Scott, Kirby Yates, allegedly, sign with the Dodgers was tough, but dismissing or scoffing at fans' frustrations feels unproductive. When fans say, quote, the Dodgers are bad for baseball, I think it's less about blaming the Dodgers themselves. This is a great point. And more about the systemic imbalance that allows certain teams to dominate. The Dodgers' high-profile moves naturally highlight this disparity, making them an easy target for criticism. This is very level-headed for a Padres fan. I don't mean that, like, dismissively. Like, this is very impressive critical thinking. Fans aren't ignoring cheap small-market owners. Every single fan of a small-market team wishes their owner would spend more. But we want reforms, like through the CBA, to create a fairer playing field.
Yeah, and so I think this is, and I don't mean this as like you're being a hypocrite, but it is amazing to me for Padres fans in particular who felt the positive side of having an owner willing to push beyond whatever, you know, regardless of whatever rules were in place, whether it's the CBT, whether it's all these things. It's just a matter of what they want to do. And this is what Jeff Passan kind of wrote about, talking about this in far more eloquent words than we will attempt in the next few minutes, about while it is totally understandable that fans feel frustrated by the imbalances and the structural advantages that teams like the Dodgers have, there are also a lot of teams that have similar spending power and are choosing not to, right? And so when you have situations like what we just have with Tanner Scott, for example, where it's like, all right, well, the Cubs decided to stop offering more than $66 million, and the Dodgers are like, all right, well, we'll go to $72 million. That's a choice that they made, right? There are teams that can afford these things that are choosing not to. And we just saw the Padres, who previously we thought, okay, well, there's no way they can afford it. They, all right, well, actually, no, we can't afford to extend all of our players for 10 more years, and we can pay because we want to, because we care, we want to invest. And so the Dodgers wanting to do this more than everyone else, to me, is not the only reason they can do it. As Andy astutely pointed out, the thing that I really took away from your conversation earlier this week is just the constant reminder that, yes, Ohtani's contract and them getting him changed their business model and empowered them to spend money in ways that we have not seen them spend before. This was not a team that was blasting into the luxury tax before, even 2 years ago, even when they were spending a lot of money. They are now in a new era of flexing their money, and that is because of Ohtani, full stop. There is no way around that. But that is also an achievement for them to get him. And luck. I mean, it's luck. A lot of it is luck for Ohtani, the superstar, to be wanting to structure his contract like that and all those things that come along with it. But I say all that to just say that, like, yes. As he mentions, it's not about blaming the Dodgers himself. It's that we want changes, which I think then is a helpful transition to the third point.
I think the best point in this chunk or the thing that has impacted my thinking the most is I don't think it's about getting the Dodgers to spend less. I think it's about getting the other teams to spend more. Right. And obviously those two things are connected. But I think that we want to raise the floor for the health of the game rather than pushing the ceiling down. Last point here from Dalton. Lastly, your reaction to the MLB trade rumors poll calling respondents idiots felt dismissive. The fact that half of the fans polled would forego a season for CBA reform speaks to deep frustration within the league structure. Many small market fans feel left behind and their frustrations deserve more empathy, especially from voices like yours who so thoughtfully cover the game. I cannot, or at least before this email, could not conceive of someone wanting to forego 162 baseball games for this. Now, maybe that's because the team that I care about, the Baltimore Orioles, has like was totally irrelevant and terrible for 5 years, and they still, the process of watching them for 6 months, in a way, was like almost bet more important than like, will they ever win a World Series? Right. And so that being said, I think you're right that more than 50% of people would be willing to do that. I still don't totally understand it, but guess what? Sometimes in America, there are 50% of people do something and that you don't understand. And I would like to now start to like, this does tell me something that something is broken. Yeah. Because if 50% of fans do feel that way, then it matters, right? Mm-hmm. If people feel a way, then it's relevant. Even if I, Jake Mintz, can't,
yes,
comprehend not watching a baseball game for 500 days so that the Guggenheim group can't spend as much money. Like, I would rather watch the Reds on a Tuesday in May, even if the Dodgers win the next three championships.
Yes. And so I'm with you because my first response was the same as yours that you had on the show earlier this week. I it's difficult for me to wrap my mind around. Now, obviously, we have extremely biased and just like we have a warped view of any notion of missing a season for a lot of obvious reasons. I think the thing that I keep coming back to when we talk about reforms and we talk about what needs to change, whether it's a salary cap or not, this goes back to the second point and about wanting the other teams to spend more. It's not just that they want to spend more. It's that the behavior and the way that teams treat or that owners treat the business of owning a baseball team. Almost no matter what rules you put in place, there will always be owners who view the objective slightly differently. And I don't think, I don't know what you could put in play. Yes, you could put in a salary cap that makes it harder for the Dodgers to assemble a roster that's going to be projected to win 110 games. That's true. Based on the way that they operate and the people in charge, they would still be one of the teams, if not the team, that is pushing the hardest to, within whatever new, you know, arena that you have, to get to a level that is more competitive than everybody else. And so now, as our friend Jeff Passan wrote, like, this is a stress test because while they have not won five World Series in a row yet, the way that some people seem to be talking about, well, baseball still does have incredible parity. While we are still just 16 months removed from the Dodgers getting swept by the D-backs who won, you know, 16 fewer games than them in the regular season, all of that is still possible. And whether they're bad for baseball, whether there is a version of this that clearly there is an imbalance, 100%. Some that have always existed and some that have been exacerbated by ownership behavior and ownership across the league, when you combine all of the ways that they are deciding to run their teams in contrast to the Dodgers, it ain't look great. It just doesn't. And I totally get that. But I also think that it is about the way that these groups decide to run their teams and want to run their teams. And by the way, that also extends to teamless like the Mets, who have more money than everybody. They have more money than even the Dodgers, at least Steve Cohen does, right? Or at least close, they're the team closest. And they are clearly this offseason at certain junctures deciding to draw the line, deciding to say, you know what? We aren't just going to outbid everybody else for this. We are going to, yes, of course they were able to do it with Juan Soto, but they are deciding, no, we are going to run it this way. This is our vision for it. Whereas the Dodgers, as Andy pointed out, it's so funny in contrast to, you know, 5 or so years ago where they were like, oh no, we can't spend. Clearly now, the other interesting thing coming from Andrew Friedman is that he's saying, I do not want to make moves in July. he has said this publicly now over the last year or so. He said, I do not enjoy trading away prospects that, of course, we've drafted and developed.
What a privilege.
Aside. Yeah. So let's just pay for it because we can. And so that is something that not every team can do. But I think that that is a perspective that you have to respect to some degree.
I think the frustration is totally legitimate. Mm-hmm. If David Peralta had hit a 3-run home run in game 5 of the NLDS, we wouldn't, it wouldn't
be the timing of this same is just
energy because
everything 100%.
Then the energy would be, well, of course the Dodgers are spending like this. They need to go get that ring.
Mm-hmm. It's also, again, the contrast to what we were saying a year ago when they signed Ohtani and it was like, okay, great. Ohtani, this is what you need. You've already have all these other guys, but you still need him to finally win a World Series. And guess what? They immediately won the World Series. Now, they almost lost to the Padres, but they did it. And so, yes, the timing of all of this is absolutely magnifying this discussion for better or for worse, because I think to Dalton's point, like there are a lot of these are real. I can't pretend like people don't feel this way when you see polls like this and you see some of the ways that people respond, even if I disagree with some of the premises.
So my last point here, and then we'll take a break. I think the biggest problem that is created by the Dodgers' immense spending is that it incentivizes players to reach free agency. Free agency is good. Players should be making the money that they have earned. However, if you are a team in a small market, a fan of a team in a small market, you want the really good player on your team to be there forever. That's what matters. I think that part of the reason that the Rays don't get anybody into the stadium besides where it is and whatever is they don't keep players around for a long time. They don't allow fans to develop meaningful relationships with the players that they're watching every day. I think the Guardians keeping Jose Ramirez around, like that's a huge freaking deal. Huge deal. If the Guardians didn't have Jose Ramirez as a centerpiece and they were just trading Josh Naylor and every player right before they hit free agency, fans would be infuriated all the time, right? Be like,
and they still are to some degree.
They still are to some degree, which is totally valid. And so I want the league to operate in a way where if I am a Pirates fan, I genuinely believe Paul Skeens will wear a Pirates uniform for the rest of his career. That the Pirates have the financial incentives and wherewithal to make that a reality. That is important. And if the Dodgers' dominance chips away at that, I think that is a problem. And I think Dalton and his email helped kind of put some of those pieces together in my mind. However, I think as interesting as this is, we got to wait until November. If the Dodgers win again, then let's pick it back up.
Here's
right?
the other but thing. If, yeah. Yeah.
Like no. We don't know yet. We don't know yet.
Yes.
Right. Because baseball might just be random enough to withstand this. And I hope it is. Right. And that's the best thing. And I just want to say the concern that you're feeling as a fan of a small market team is legitimate. And I think that when we look at the league from the lens of the league and not one team, and I said this to Andy, like that changes the way you look at it. And I think I got a little bit too lost in the weeds, if that makes sense. All right. Last paragraph. I hope this comes across as constructive feedback rather than criticism for criticism's sake. Best, Dalton. Dalton, it did.
Thank you,
look
Dalton.
At that.
Thank you for listening.
Thank you.
I appreciate it. You can email us at baseballbarbicast@gmail.com. We're going to take a quick break. And when we return, we're talking about Jurickson and Profar and give you the good, the bad, the ugly.
And welcome back to Baseball Barbicast. Jake Mintz, Jordan Schusterman. The Atlanta Braves had been one of the sleepiest teams this winter. They had not signed a player to a Major League Baseball contract, which is helpful if you're trying to win Major League Baseball games. That changed last night as they agreed to a 3-year, $42 million deal with Jurickson Profar.
No-brainer fit. There are a few teams that really need corner outfield help that had money. And the Braves were a team where like, do they have money? I don't know. They weren't that close to the first, you know, CBT luxury tax line that they have seemingly generally tried to avoid in recent years. But they weren't doing anything. They made a few moves. Remember, they dumped Jorge Soler early in the offseason. They restructured some contracts, and then they went silent, hadn't signed anybody. They had signed Brian De La Cruz to a minor league deal, and it was like, really? This is their plan in the outfield until Ronald Acuna Jr. gets back? And no. Ultimately, Profar stayed on the market long enough for them to scoop him up for, I mean, listen, this deal reflects how kind of incredible it was that this breakout that he just had in 2024, one of the more astonishing across the board improvements to a game that we've seen in a long time. Yes, you could say, oh, well, of course, guys, it's Jurickson Profar, top prospect, whatever. The kinds of gains he made offensively, the plate discipline has always been there, right? He has always, you know, walked a lot and not struck out a lot. And that's the on base skills have always been there. For his power grade to essentially jump two, three ticks in his age 32 season is pretty amazing. And he was one of the best hitters of baseball last year. He was one of the most important players on the Padres. And now he will be when Acuna comes back. I mean, that's a sexy outfield with Michael Harris and Acuna and Profar, assuming Profar is something close to what he was in 2024 again.
Alex Anthopoulos, the Pobo of the Braves, referred to Profar as, quote, the second best bat on the market, which I assume, number one, he's talking about Danny Jansen.
Yeah.
Juan Soto. Here's where I'm at on Profar. I would rather be wrong saying thanks but no thanks than be wrong the other way. Because he was so bad before last year. Really. Like,
he was the year before, but it's not like he'd been a terrible player for 10 years. I mean, he had seemingly been fine. Like, he was okay.
Sure.
But yes, now,
he's a bad defensive
outfielder. Yeah. Yeah.
And I'm so happy for him that he is getting paid here. Yeah. Look, this could turn out to be great. If he does what he did last year, it's a bargain. If he does half of what he did last year, it's a bargain. I'd rather get burnt the other way if I'm running a team. That's a weird way to think about it. It's such a ridiculous sudden change in a player. And this stuff happens sometimes. Yeah. It scares me.
I'm with you. However, at this price, I mean, for him to get less than Tyler O'Neill, because again, obviously when you sign your free agent and you have the press conference, you're going to pump him up. But like, Alex Anthopoulos didn't have to say what he said, which is say that he was as bad on the market. And he chose to say that. That is something that he must believe to some degree. And again, right, that's not okay, of course, Soto, but like, right. But him compared to Willy Adames for four times the price compared to Santander, right? That Santander and Teoscar are probably the better comparisons because of the limited defensive value provided. And how those guys, and then you lump in O'Neill, how those four outfielders perform in 2025, forget the length of the contract. Let's just talk about this first year where all those teams are really hoping that, of course, whatever, if Teoscar sucks, the Dodgers will be fine. But the Blue Jays banking big on Santander, the Orioles, clearly their biggest expenditure this offseason being Tyler O'Neill. This will be a really, really fun comparison to watch. As for, you know, the Braves, I mean, yeah, it's a no-brainer fit. Like, they were originally going to roll with Kelnick and Brian De La Cruz in a platoon. Now that will basically cover right field until Acuna comes back, and then, you know, they can kind of fade into the background. So I don't know. I'm totally with you, but at this price, man, it feels like a lot of teams could feel pretty stupid passing on this.
Calling him the second best free agent bat, did he just sort by WRC plus? Maybe. Yes.
I think that's exactly what happened. Now, let's also just mention quickly that the Padres are now it's not going great. And we didn't have to tell you that. I'm not trying to like kick him while they're down. But boy, for anyone holding out hope that Profar was going to go back to San Diego, it felt like he, I'm sure, wanted to go back to San Diego and was just waiting for them to find the money, which this doesn't look like that much, especially by Padres standards in recent years. But the fact that they are just kind of stuck in the mud with this ownership dispute, they also have not signed a major league free agent. And the bottom of this roster right now is just brutal. I mean, maybe Tirso or Nellis will prove us wrong, but they are without, I mean, to lose Profar, who had the most plate appearances on their team. And by the way, it's not just Profar. It's Donovan Solano. It's Ha-Sung Kim. It's Kyle Higashioka. Like, you can laugh, but like, those were really important parts of their team last year. And those guys are gone too, and clearly not coming back. So I don't know what the path forward is. You're certainly running out of options. And as we know, they do not have a lot of money to spend. So I don't know if it's going to require a trade or anything. This is still a good team. They have good players, but I really feel for Padres fans for more reasons than one. And while, yes, losing Sasaki hurts for a lot of reasons that we don't have to explain, losing Profar when you realize the change from what he did to them last year, it hurts in a totally different way that I think we're really starting to grapple with now as we start to project what this roster is going to look like on opening day.
The top of the roster is still outrageously talented. And if you get this team in a 5-game series in the playoffs, they're horrifying. But then the question just becomes, can they get there? Right?
Yeah.
If they can get in, they're dangerous.
Yeah.
But the depth here, and depth is important over 6 months, the depth is really, really concerning.
Yeah.
Non-existent. This doesn't exist. All right. Relievers, very briefly, and then good, bad, ugly.
Yes. Paul Sewald to the Guardians. This was lovely news to see on my trip home. Paul Sewald's great. How good is Paul Sewald, the pitcher now? Of course, this breakout with the Mariners turns into this funky, dominant closer, strikeout artist. He's pitching with the Diamondbacks in the World Series. Had some injuries in his final year in Arizona where he kind of fell down the Diamondbacks closer depth chart. But the Guardians picking him up is very cool and fun, not just because I'll get to talk to Paul Sewald more, but because the Guardians coming off the year where they had the best bullpen in baseball and being like, we still need more help and we are betting on Paul Sewald for $7 million now that we have some money to spend because the Blue Jays took Miles Straw's contract. Where does Paul Sewald fit in, right? This is a hedge that like, okay, this bullpen can't be nearly as good again, which is probably true. So that's smart.
Very smart.
But Paul Sewald's not going to close over Class A, but like, is he going to even get the eighth over Cade Smith? Probably not. So where Sewald fits in, I like it. It's a nice balance to their super young bullpen that otherwise exists.
It's a fascinating thing because just to see the Guardians spend money on a reliever feels weird to me.
Sure.
Right?
Yeah. When they can conjure up these other guys, like out of nowhere. Yeah, it's true.
Deal I love. The Mets signing AJ Minter for 2 years, $22 million. Minter missed, I believe, all or most of last season.
It was just the last like 2 months.
Oh, it was the last 2 months.
Yeah, but he was clearly hampered. He ended up getting a season-ending hip surgery. But I mean, I tweeted about this time. I mean, he's been one of the best left-handed relievers in baseball for the last 5 years.
He's really good.
Consistent. So the health is a question mark, right? Hip surgery is no small thing. But I can understand wanting to give him this contract instead of paying Tanner Scott what he got when we talk about the volatility of relievers. So this could end up being like a David Stearns masterclass. It's maybe not as much of a sure thing because of the injury, and Scott at his best, yes, is better than Minter at his best, but Minter is really, really good. And that's another thing that, you know, as the Mets and Braves, you know, will be jockeying in the NL East, AJ Minter might get some big outs against Atlanta, and that'll be fun to watch.
Left-handed relievers, lowest ERAs last 5 seasons, 150 inning limit. He's number 3. It's really good. He's a really, really good player.
Yep.
Like really, really good.
Yep.
That's it.
So I assume, right, again, I assume he's healthy, but we'll see. Reliever market keeps on moving, but we also have to keep on moving because it's the end of the Friday edition of Baseball Rubbercast, which means it's time for the good, the bad, the ugly. Give me something good, Jake.
I want to hop back to the Hall of Fame announcement where Josh Rawich, who is the president of the Hall and who announces...
Great guy.
The
Love Josh.
Players, great guy. Two things that were good from this year. At the beginning, in previous years, I believe, not he, but whoever is doing the announcement will say, this year's class is 3 players or 4 players or 1 player. He said several players, which was great because you didn't know going into it how many it was going to be, and it kept the suspense. But more than that, the moment, I believe it was Brian Kenny asking Josh Rawich, did Ichiro get 100% of the vote? Okay. Because Josh did not say unanimous. And I believe he would have. And for Josh to have to deliver that unfortunate news that one person didn't vote for him, the tone that Josh carried, watch it back. He's smiling through it and because he doesn't, like, everyone is like, oh, but Josh can't do that because he's here to pump up the Hall of Fame, right, as it should be, right? I thought he did it in a perfect way where he's just like, 99.3% of the vote, all but one. And then, like, he and Brian kind of just, like, smiling at each other, like, oh, it was good. Tough act to do. Well done.
Yeah. Josh is great. That's very funny. I did not see that because I was on vacation, which is related to my good. I was in the Bahamas for a few days. And we got to go there for a couple times to attend the Home Run Derby in Paradise, hosted by some Bahamian baseball players. And my good, this week, we have not attended in a few years. However, my good this week is talking to people in the Bahamas about Jazz. Jazz Chisholm Jr., of course, who is currently the most, you know, famous Bahamian baseball player. Just talk, because especially in Nassau, where it's a small island and everybody knows each other, of course I found people that knew Jazz when he was younger and all these things, and just like talking to the people who know him and have known him since he was younger and now know him as, you know, famous baseball player in the Yankees is delightful. And I just had a rejuvenation of appreciation for the Bahamian people and Bahamian baseball. And I will use this as a way to just mention Sebastian Walcott as a baseball thing to keep in your mind in 2025. This is a player who could be better than Jazz, and you should pay attention to him. But Jazz makes me happy, and his collab with Clemson Baseball that I saw over the weekend is one of the more random things I've ever seen, and it also made me happy. So that is my good, talking to Bahamians about Jazz.
What is bad? The Pittsburgh Pirates are bad at winning games, at least recently. And over last week, I guess they did Pirates Fest. What do they call it? Pirates Jamboree. They all have different names. Yeah. Andrew McCutchen was there. So
I
cool.
I hope so. Yeah.
He's always there and he's coming back.
That's where you'll find him.
But Andrew McCutchen was not there. Andrew McCutchen was there. And that's because the Pirates misspelled Andrew McCutchen's name on the name tag in front of where he was signing autographs.
Yeah. Yeah.
This is so bad. This cannot happen. You can misspell literally any other player's name on the team. Like
Skeens?
Sure. Honestly, yeah. It's a tough name. Like maybe there's an A.
Skeens hasn't earned his correct name spelling yet.
Like if you misspell, I mean, who's on the Pirates?
So
Nick York's name.
Nick
okay.
York, no E, yeah.
You forget the E on Nick York, right? Sure.
It's Nick Gonzalez with a Z instead of an S. Yeah, that's all fine.
It's literally Andrew McCutchen, dude. Like, it's not as if you need to check the spelling. Whoever printed that out,
no,
right?
No.
Now, the funniest part is that he even has a name tag. Because if you're going to Pirates Fest, I think you know which one is Andrew McCutchen.
Excellent point. That is really the most important point here. Now, lucky for them, Andrew McCutchen is the coolest guy in the world. And so he then like recorded a video making fun of it for the Padres social. They just were like, yeah, see, this is, he covered up the H on the back of his jersey. But again, you're fortunate that you have someone like Kutch who is just going to love the Pirates forever, no matter what. So I still agree that this goes into bad. My bad this week is Ipe Mizuhara stealing $17 million from Shohei Ohtani. Now, this is not news. This is not new. However, we do have a development in that there was exclusive audio released, obtained by The Athletic, of Ipe making a phone call to a bank and attempting to transfer money while pretending to be Shohei Ohtani. And you can listen to it, and he's like, who am I speaking with? And it's clearly Ipe saying, you're speaking with Shohei Ohtani. I need all this money. I'm trying to transfer $200,000. This is bad. It's bad because it's a reminder of just how far off the rails this situation went. And it's bad that anybody ever thought that this was some sort of grand cover-up. And now Ipe will go to jail for what seems like they're looking for 5 years in prison. And that's bad, too, because going to jail is bad. But this is, it's just like, again, this story will never cease to amaze me. It bums me out because at the end of the day, it is like a story of betrayal. And, you know, that sucks. So
it does. I kind of think it'd be hilarious, though, if Ipe escaped prison.
Oh, interesting.
I think Ipe bad, stealing that money bad. Ipe prison break.
I mean, hilarious. Maybe again, we're going to have a lot more media content around this story in the future years. Like there will be movies. Yeah. That is going to happen. How that is portrayed will be interesting. But as I ready to go down to Arizona and I reflect that, you know, a year ago, I was watching Ipe hanging out with Shohei on the backfields and he will not be there this year. So that will be, he will be probably in jail by then. So we'll see how that all goes. But yeah, this clip, if you haven't listened to it or it's like, yeah, no, he was calling the bank and and everyone at the time would be like, how could he do that? It's like, yeah, I listened to it. They're literally, the bank person literally asked him like, hey, we're concerned about fraud. We got to make sure, like, you sure this is someone? It's like,
he's like, hey, Ipe, we're concerned about fraud. Oh,
really? What are you talking about? All right, anyway.
Are you going to need more? Are you going to need more money? Possibly.
What's your UGLA?
My UGLA is Fanatics, clothing company. So I was doing some spring cleaning, and I tweeted out a picture of all of my jerseys, a collection that I am quite proud of. That is, I haven't really added to in recent years, but just shows that, you know, maybe I don't have all my marbles upstairs when I own a Ryan Doma jersey. Fanatics quote tweeted this, like the Fanatics account quote tweeted this and said, how does your collection match up? Now, originally I was going to say this is bad because Fanatics, since taking over the textile merchandise distribution of baseball apparel, has been a disaster for jersey collectors like myself because they reduced the flow of jerseys in favor of expensive jerseys, which, good business, sure, whatever, but bad. And for them to be like, how does your collection stack up, even though it's impossible to collect these now because of us, that made me mad. However, I have to say, the reason it's ugly and not bad, their selection on Fanatics.com has been better than I thought. I went and I did some research, and you can get a Brewers Joey Weimer jersey on there for $15. Just like you could in the old days when you'd go to lids.com and you sort by lowest price and you get the players who aren't really that relevant or on new teams. That's how you do this, okay?
That's the secret sauce right there, or was.
If I'm an Orioles fan and I really want to buy a Jorge Mateo jersey, I cannot do that. You cannot customize anything you want anymore. That's bad. But Fanatics, that I can buy a Steven Strasburg City Connect jersey that he's never worn. All right.
I'm kind of intrigued. I'm encouraged. I'm kind of loving this. Here's a weird transition. I had another UGLA plan, but we don't have a lot of time, so I'm going to keep this quick, and I feel like we have to mention this. Here would be a jersey that I would love to purchase at some point, probably 5 or 10 years down the line. Tim Anderson, Marlins, or Tim Anderson, Angels, as TA7 has inked a minor league deal with the Angels of Anaheim. Why is this ugly? I don't know. I just wanted to talk about it. He has been the worst player in baseball for the last 2 years. It bums me out because, remember, we went from Tim Anderson, you know, all-star, batting title, Team USA, World Baseball Classic 2023, Mark DeRosa is like, Tim Anderson is the best. He's playing second base. Oh my God.
Walk off in the corn,
all these things. Doesn't get better than Tim Anderson. And then it doesn't get worse, unfortunately, than Tim Anderson on the field, as he was so bad for the White Sox in 2023. And then it was like, oh my God, like, well, okay, sign with the Marlins. Let's see if we can bounce back. somehow got even worse. And so now the fact that he's still trying to play, I'm glad, but no one picked him up after the Marlins dumped him last year. The Angels always felt like an obvious marriage here, as Zach Neto is injured and they are probably going to need some infield depth at some point. I hope that Ron Washington and whoever else is on the Angels coaching staff and whatever environment that will take, I hope we still have another Tim Anderson moment in the major leagues. I'm not super optimistic because of how bad it has gotten, but I would love for it to happen. And I guess the Angels in theory can give him that opportunity. So it remains ugly because I definitely do not know whether this is going to be good or bad. But Tim Anderson's career and his baseball reference page right now is tracking like a true all-time WTF happened here. And I hope that it has at least one more bounce back up towards respectability. That is my ugly.
All right, I need to go catch a flight. Goodbye.
Bye. Thank you all for listening. Thank you, producer Andrew Hartz, for making this happen. It's so good to be back. We will be back next week on Baseball Barbercast. You can email us, baseballbarbercast@gmail.com. Thank you all for listening. Talk to you soon.